Can we help avoid infants who are born small for gestational age?
Making the best oxygen therapy for people with COVID.
What about preventing dental caries in children younger than 5?
And the safety and immune response of different COVID-19 booster vaccines.
That's what we're talking about this week on Double T Health Watch, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a Baltimore-based medical journalist.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, how about if we turn straight to The Lancet? This is a study that many people are thinking about quite a lot. It's a study that was conducted in the UK, taking a look at 7 COVID-19 vaccines in their booster role. And well, how did they do?
Let me set the background. It's clear that people should have booster vaccinations after they've received full vaccination because immunity wanes, measured with the antibodies, probably T-cell immunity also. So the recommendation is to get a booster 6 months after you've received the initial vaccine. Now, do you get the same one or do you get a different booster? There's some thought that getting a different type of booster can actually broaden the immune response. On the other hand, get a different vaccine booster could actually make it less safe. And so what these authors did was they took individuals that had received 2 vaccines, either with the AstraZeneca or with the Pfizer mRNA vaccines, and then were said to get their booster dose. And as you mentioned, they gave 7 different vaccines. Now, some of these were mRNA vaccines, some nanoparticles, some whole inactivated virus, some full dose, some half dose. It's a pretty complicated scheme. But the overall gist was, okay, what they found is with one exception, with one vaccine in the individuals that received Pfizer previously, all of the vaccines elicited an increase in the immune response that would be considered appropriate. And they seemed to increase also the T cell response as well. There wasn't an increase and safety concerns. Now, if you used a half a dose as opposed to a full dose of some of the booster vaccines, there were less systemic side effects, but the pain was about the same. But why that can be important is some countries don't have enough vaccine to give full dose booster doses, and they could give half dose and get the same immune response. This is a great study done in almost 3,000 individuals. Your take?
Wait, before we do that, you sort of foreshadowed with one exception. So when you were saying with one exception, what were you talking about?
It was a booster called Valneva. It was a whole inactivated SARS-CoV-2 virus that didn't have the same immune response in those that had received the Pfizer vaccine, but it was effective in those that had gotten the AstraZeneca vaccine previously.
Of course, some people are interpreting this study to mean that the Moderna vaccine was actually superior to the Pfizer vaccine with regard to the eliciting of an immune response.
It's kind of interesting because there was a varied immune response. The immune response was sufficient in every case, except the one I mentioned, to say, yes, the booster was effective. Sometimes it boosted the antibodies as much as 2-fold, sometimes 32-fold. Unfortunately, there's not a good correlation between the antibody response and how effective the vaccines are. But it does look like you can give a heterogeneous booster, that is a different one than you got initially, and get an immune response and it be safe.
I think the safety data is really persuasive. And I would also, though, ask the question about sort of the breadth of the immune response and the benefits of having multiple different types of antibodies.
Yep, there is a consensus that having a different vaccine can broaden the antibody response and perhaps broaden coverage as well.
Okay. Let's turn to a very, very, very common problem. In fact, more common than I thought it was. I've been educated, and this is in JAMA. The USPSTF has taken a look at dental caries in children 5 years and younger, saying, all right, is there something that we can do about this? I had no idea that dental caries is the most common chronic disease in children in the US, with almost a quarter of all kids between the ages of 2 and 5 having cavities in their primary teeth. Did you know that?
Elizabeth, I was not aware of that. And I'll take it a step further. Even by the age of 1 year, 10% of kids will have cavities.
Disconcerting. We also see that the prevalence is higher in Mexican-American children, a third of them, and non-Hispanic Black children, about 28%, than in white children, about 18%. Well, all right. So what? Those teeth fall out anyway. Well, it turns out that, of course, there's some pain, loss of teeth, impaired growth, decreased weight gain, negative effects on quality of life, poor school performance, and future dental caries in the permanent teeth. In their way, of course, the USPSTF examined the evidence that was out there and said there is a moderate net benefit for preventing future dental caries with oral fluoride supplementation in places where there is not fluoridated water or where the public water supply is deficient. And it turns out that there's actually a resource where people can go and look at that. It's a CDC resource to see whether or not their fluoridation in their area is sufficient. They also conclude with moderate certainty that there's a moderate net benefit in the prevention of future dental caries by the application of a fluoride varnish. It's easy to do, and it's probably a good idea.
I was actually surprised to find out that the American Academy of Pediatrics and the American Academy of Pediatric Dentistry and the American Dental Association, by the way, all recommend that a child see a dentist before age one. Yet less than 2% of individuals, babies across the U.S. actually occurs. Now, most of them see a primary care physician, about 90% do, and they're the ones that can actually apply the dental fluoride, but that happens in less than 10% of kids. So that's why these recommendations are really important.
It sort of tickled me that they trained primary care physicians to both detect and to apply this varnish. They were able to have a really good result when they did that.
Yeah. And as I mentioned, you know, they did a study of over 6 million children enrolled in Medicaid plans in 39 different states. Absent that training, only 8% received fluoride varnish from their primary care clinician. Does that mean that children shouldn't see a dentist? No, not really, because although the primary care physician can apply fluoride, they're not really good at looking for examining cavities. That's why it's important that the young children still see a dentist.
Staying in JAMA, now let's turn to, gosh, can we just give somebody high flow oxygen? Does that help to prevent them when they're COVID infected and ultimately requiring a ventilator?
For our listeners who aren't familiar, if someone has a decreased oxygen in their bloodstream, oftentimes what we'll do is we'll put a nasal cannula, a little plastic tube. Oxygen flows through that nasal cannula at about 2 to 4 liters per minute. Now, the use of high flow nasal cannula is a technique whereby they give a mixture of heated and humidified oxygen at very high flow rates, up to 60 liters per minute. Question is, in someone that has COVID and presents with decreased arterial saturation, should we just apply nasal cannula and then work our way up to high flow oxygen? Or should we just start with high flow oxygen? Does the latter prevent the need for mechanical ventilation, putting a tube down, and does it help people recover quicker? It took 220 individuals in 3 different hospitals in Colombia that all had COVID and respiratory distress. And half of them, they put on regular oxygen. The other half, they put on high flow nasal cannula right off the bat, and they followed the individuals. And what they found out was that in those that had the high flow nasal oxygen, they decreased the need for a ventilator by 38%. And it also increased recovery. This is good news in terms of preventing mechanical ventilation and improving recovery.
And it makes a lot of sense to me because, as we know, there's a whole constellation of things that accompany mechanical ventilation that maybe are the things that really end up causing the post-traumatic stress disorder and all the other sequelae of being in the ICU.
Yes, mechanical ventilation is obviously invasive. And as you mentioned, it's associated with sedation. People have delirium and they have neuromuscular paralysis. So we want to prevent that if we can.
My question about this study is, it seems like one of those studies that I refer to as duh, like hiding in plain sight. How come no one hasn't done this before?
This type of therapy has proven to be effective in people who have severe respiratory issues. But the question is, in the COVID individuals where it hasn't progressed already to the severe form, can this be effective? And that's really never been shown before.
So hopefully we'll be employed. Finally, then, let's turn to something that I thought was actually really rather charming. This is a study that was conducted in Barcelona in women who are pregnant and who were at risk for delivering children who are small for gestational age. Let me just mention, we're still in JAMA. They enrolled these women. They had 1,200 of them, and they basically divided them into 3 groups. One of them got a Mediterranean diet where they received 2 hours monthly of individual and group educational sessions and free extra virgin olive oil and walnuts. Then they had a stress reduction group. who underwent an 8-week stress reduction program adapted for pregnancy, where they had weekly 2.5-hour sessions and one full day session learning all of these techniques and employing them. And then they had their usual care group. Both the Mediterranean diet group and the stress reduction group actually delivered fewer infants who were small for gestational age. In the control group, they had about 22% of these SGA infants small for gestational age. In the Mediterranean diet group, it was 14%. And in the stress reduction group, it was 16%. So pretty significant reduction in this outcome. They also looked at a composite adverse perinatal outcome that occurred in 105 newborns. And that was 26% in the control group, about 19% in the Mediterranean diet group, and 19% in the stress reduction group. So again, they saw this reduction. I was just really amazed by this. What are your thoughts?
So, Elizabeth, it's interesting because this is a novel finding. It demonstrates that both nutritional and psychological interventions can have a clinically important effect in terms of fetal growth. I do need to take a step back for just a second and say that other studies that have looked at the Mediterranean diet in individuals with hypertension or obesity, diabetes, haven't necessarily shown these same results in terms of preventing small for gestational age. So this needs to be confirmed. This population was a little bit different. It's primarily white individuals, a normal body mass, and they were medium to high socioeconomic status. With regard to stress reduction, this is a high resource endeavor. It's not easy to administer this. So whether this is generalizable still remains to be seen. This is really interesting, showing that factors that could decrease inflammation and stress could potentially improve fetal outcomes. It needs to be confirmed before we recommend this for everybody.
I would also note that not only is the stress reduction pretty resource intensive, but even the food situation and the modification of diet and so forth was also something that required staff resources and some vigilance. This is where I kind of fall back. Is it the extra attention and the individualized kind of therapy that ended up being so powerful for these women?
And that's a good point, because they compared to this, quote, usual care, and the usual care doesn't involve this intensive type therapy. It would have been nice to have a control group where you still provide this regular follow-up, regular meetings, but you don't provide all this helpful information. You know, most of the nutritional advice we provide to women focus on addressing deficiencies. If a woman has iron deficiency or folate deficiency or iodine deficiency, we promote appropriate weight gain and to avoid toxins to the fetus, such as mercury, alcohol, and tobacco. We don't usually provide nutritional counseling regarding the Mediterranean diet. I still think it's really interesting. I hope it's confirmed in future studies.
Me too. And then also, we'll just note that they're continuing to collect outcomes related to these infants until they get to be about 2 years of age. So we're going to probably hear some more about this. On that note, then, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.